Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the Coen brothers and their 1984 film Blood Simple. We're turning on the show today to talk about Blood Simple's Professor Merriweather. Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
So this is the Coen brothers, for those who don't know, this is the Coen brothers' first film debut. And it's a very confident, at least for me, very confident debut film. You look at debut film from some directors, like, for example, you look at Fear and Desire, which was Kubrick's first film. That's not a very good movie, and that's sort of pretty amateurish. It took him a while to get to where he was. Like, this movie, it almost seems like right from the get-go, they knew exactly what kind of films they were going to make. Like, this almost sets the tone for, like, every Coen brothers film ever made, almost.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. There's some people that, when they're directors, when they're just coming out of the gate and they're doing their first couple of movies, that there is some stumbling and there's kind of a learning curve. But then you have people like Damien Chazelle, and his first film was Whiplash, and I love that. And then, you know, Orwell's first film was Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're right. It's just like you can see the trajectory of where these guys are going to go. Anything down to like the humor, the darkness of the humor, the controlled tight shots that they have, some of the musical cues, some of the blocking and the setting. Of course, you got Frances McDormand in that, which, you know, she obviously pops up a lot throughout their whole filmography because Joel's married to her. Some of the editing style starts to shine through. So yeah, you can. This is kind of like a blueprint, and there's some critics, because I've been reading up on these guys lately, and there's some critics that say they actually never got any better than Blood Simple, that this was like their best work, and everything else has kind of been more derivative. I don't agree with that necessarily.
No, not me
either.
Some people
argue really hard that the first two movies, the Blood Simple and the Raising Arizona, are because they had to be so fastidious, because they only made Blood Simple for $750,000, which, you know, is mind blowing. Even from an independent filmmaker perspective, that's not a lot of money.
Nope, not even for 1984 money.
Yeah, exactly. And to think that, you know, and they also did Raising Arizona on a relatively shoestring budget too. Like these are their first two movies, and they just knew that they had to. I mean, everything is storyboarded. You know, this is where you get that classic making sure that they have every single shot worked out before they get to actual shooting, to actual production, so that they are as lean as possible on takes. The actors are super, super prepared for what they're supposed to be doing. So it's just distilled. It's all distilled down. And when you look at, when you compare and contrast them with directors that do like a bajillion takes, like a David Fincher or a Stanley Kubrick or a Robert Altman, and you're just like, this is the complete opposite of that. And, you know, there's like, I saw an interview with Frances McDormand where she was just saying, the first things I ask my directors when I meet them for the first time is, do you storyboard? And, you know, she says, and I can always tell that they're thinking in the back of their minds, well, Joel and Ethan must storyboard. And if they say that they don't storyboard, then she's like, well, they obviously don't know what they want. Which is a heck of a statement to make.
Yeah.
That, okay, if you don't have it planned out shot by shot. And, of course, there are plenty of people out there that like to do all kinds of improvisation in their movies. And magic comes out of that, too. So, I don't know. I think there's a lot to be said on a lot of different styles. But yeah, there's just some people that want to go in, and you see that sometimes with comedy films. Like my example of the other week in class was, imagine if you had tried to plan out every single thing that the genie said in Aladdin.
Yeah.
It would have not been the same movie. I mean, when you gave Robin Williams the latitude to be able to come up with these lines so that the animators then went backwards and styled their animations to what Williams was saying, if you had tried to plan Robin Williams' speeches out ahead of time, it just would have never had that kind of spark and that magic. So I get when Frances McDormand says, well, if you don't storyboard, you obviously don't know what you're looking for. Because, you know, there is, there's a lot to be said about planning things out, but, you know, there's other people that have more money or more latitude of time on their production schedules, and they don't have to plan things down to the minutia.
Yeah, it's a good point, but like you said, like with this movie, it almost, like, it does feel like they've planned everything out, where all the shots, especially the shot when he's burying these, it's at the nighttime, and he's burying the boss alive. Just everything feels like, once again, they had a vision, and it seems early on they did. There was no improv or anything involved. What's interesting about this film is that they shot the trailer before they shot the movie. They shot this trailer for this idea they had. They didn't have funding, and they shot the trailer around to a bunch of potential investors so they could get the funding to complete the movie. And I know people who were in the trailer was like Bruce Campbell, and it wasn't the actors you see in the movie. It was other people.
That I did not know. That's kind of funny. Because when you do look at the actors that are in this movie, because you've got really four principal actors, and you've got Dan Getz, and I, for a minute, the whole time I was watching the movie, I'm like, I know I've seen this guy somewhere before, but I don't remember where. And you go on his IMDb page, and he's been in like 129 things and a ton of television, but as far as him being like the star of something, he really isn't past this movie. Or there are movies that are like really, really cheap, low budget, and you probably didn't see him in a theater. So he's kind of an unknown. And then you have those two amazing character actors, Emmett Walsh and Dan Hayeda. And I'm just sitting there going, they only had $750,000. How the heck did they get those two guys? And the person I was watching the movie with was, well, maybe they read the script. And I thought, well, that is kind of brilliant, because there's something so tight and well executed about every single aspect of this movie that it is so dependent upon everything else that's going on in this movie. It's just incredibly tightly controlled. And I think if you were, you know, an actor like Emmett Walsh, who could be in, say, Blade Runner, and then turn around, and I believe, like, within the same year, within the same 2 years that Blade Runner comes out, he's in this movie. You know, that really says something about how discerning he is about the kinds of scripts that he could pick. I mean, there's some people out there that, you know, they just constantly are getting into movies where you're like, why can't you read the script? This is obviously not going to help you. And then there's other people that seems like every single time they're in a movie, it's golden, and it's because they can just read scripts. They get what's going on there.
Yeah,
like, and even that early on, and the fact that the Coen brothers are completely unknown beyond, like, their you know, Joel's work with Sam Raimi, and that was just in an editing capacity. The fact that they could bring that kind of talent to the table, that's really important.
Yeah, and you talk about these actors, like you said, you didn't know John Getz, and then you looked at his IMDb, like, oh yeah, he was in that. These are like classic examples of like that guy from that thing. Like Emmett Walsh.
Yeah.
Emmett Walsh, like you said, he shows up for a couple of scenes in Blade Runner, then you never see him again. And I think he was in The Jerk. I think, like, once again, I'll look at his IMDb and I'll find him in a million different things. He was actually
He was like the doctor in Fletch.
Yeah.
And he was just like, how do you get these roles? This is so crazy.
He was even
in everything.
Yeah, he was even in their next film, Raising Arizona, for a very small scene at the beginning of the movie. So this is like a movie where he finally gets to shine, and same thing for like John Getz and Dan Hedaya. It's like all these guys, you know, from movies for like brief small roles, it seems like this is the movie where they can get something juicier.
Yeah. So I think, you know, they obviously they were going to be in a movie that was going to give them more face time, the things that they normally were involved in. These are obviously really, really incredibly competent actors. So I just think it's just cool the way this cast clicks together. And you look at Frances McDormand, and it's just like, oh my God, she was like a teenager.
Yeah.
She looks so young. And just to still see, even though this is a $750,000 movie, the way that they are setting tone through their atmospheres, their set design, and just everything is just really well done and attention to detail and tightly constructed, so that it's got almost tension built into it merely from the production values of the movie.
Yeah, and you know, bringing that up back a little bit, I know you said that you know, they sort of, before they had this debut, they worked a little bit with Sam Raimi. Talk a little bit more about that. They're good. Apparently, them and Raimi are very good friends. I know. Around the same, like a year later, they wrote a film Sam Raimi directed called Crime Wave, which is kind of this comedy. And then they have also made a couple cameos in Raimi films. Like, I know they have, there's this very small Blink and You'll Miss Them cameo they have in his film from 1990 called Darkman. And I believe Raimi also wrote the script for the film they directed, Hudsucker Proxy. So they've had this long collaboration. I can see a little bit of Raimi in this film because this is around the same time Raimi was working on the Evil Dead movies. And he was, and just like the Coens were very DIY on this film, Raimi was DIY as hell on the Evil Dead movies. Like, even in this one particular shot that felt like it was something out of Evil Dead in this movie. The scene when Padilla tries to kidnap his wife and he takes her outside and he's, you know, got her in a sleeper hold. And then the camera just like, you know, as the super zoom right up towards them, like all the way back and then going all the way right up towards their face. That's something right out of the very end of Evil Dead when one of the characters is wandering around and the spirit is riding all the way through the house really fast and right towards his face. And the final shot is the guy screaming as the evil spirit comes right up on his face. So that's,
and you know what? There's another shot like that in Raising Arizona when, and it's actually done in like three different perspectives, but one is the camera going up the stairs and into the room where the kid has been stolen from, and the wife is screaming, and you go from all the way back, all the way up to almost in her mouth as she's screaming. And it's almost kind of like this dog perspective, like it's the dog running along the floor and coming up, but it's the camera. So yeah, I definitely see what you're saying about Sam Raimi and his influence there. And another weird thing too about the Ethan Coen or Joel Coen, Sam Raimi relationship is that they both show up as extras in a movie called Spies Like Us with Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase. They're just in these bit little throwaway parts, but they're like, it's funny to see them popping up in other places.
Yeah, and even more Coen Brothers collaboration. I know when going back to Darkman, one of the stars in that movie was Frances McDormand. And
oh, no kidding!
Yes.
I've never seen that movie.
Yeah, and then it's a good one. I recommend. I'm a big Raimi fan, but even then, you know, Bruce Campbell, who you know is best known for the Evil Dead movies, is a big Raimi collaborator. Like he shows up a little bit in Hudsucker Proxy is one of the newspaper men, and he has one of the funniest little bits in Fargo where. When Peter Stormare is watching this cheesy soap opera on TV, and it's one of the people in that scene is Bruce Campbell, and it's, you know, when the woman says, "I'm pregnant,"
oh
and
my
it's
gosh,
Peter.
Oh my gosh, is that the like the soap opera one?
Yeah, where
I
she's.
I didn't realize that was Bruce Campbell. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, where the woman goes, "I'm pregnant," and then Peter Stormare's mouth just drops. I just always crack up at that scene.
I would love that, but I never caught that was Bruce Campbell. That's hysterical.
And
that's another thing, too, that I will always kind of be impressed by the Coens, and not just for their ability to get the people that they got for this movie when they were when they were unknown and broke. But the fact that, because I was trying to explain this to my students, and I was like, you know, you see people like Brad Pitt, and George Clooney's been in several of their movies.
Yep.
And some of these, like, really incredibly big-name stars. And I'm like, they're not getting paid their normal wages. They're working for union scale. And I have to explain what union scale is, because it's like, they will work in these guys' movies simply because they love working with
them. They
want
to work with them, yeah.
Yeah, and I just think that that's such a testimony to just how good people are in the industry, not just the fact that the Coen brothers are recognized for how they make movies, going back to Frances McDormand, they know exactly what they want, and they've already planned everything out ahead of time, but also the fact that these big-name stars are willing to kind of give up some of their ego and some of their gravitas to, you know, the stuff that usually Clooney ends up doing in most of Coen brothers' movies is really goofy stuff.
Yeah, especially in Burn After Reading.
And so is Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
so it's kind of funny to see, you know, the way that not only they get these guys into these movies, but also the kind of characters that these suave sort of Cary Grant looking actors are playing. Like when you look at the character that Matt Damon is playing in True Grit, and how kind of goofy looking he looks, it's just like, it's really kind of funny. It's almost like they've been allowed to go and play somewhere they're not supposed to go, and they're just out there having fun, and eventually they'll go back and be Jason Bourne, and they'll be, you know, these other roles. It just seems like it's kind of like a fun get out of school pass for a day or something like that.
Yeah, but you pronounced his name wrong. It's Matt Damon.
Matt Damon. Everybody needs to go and watch Team America World Police.
Yep.
If you haven't done so, do so now.
And but anyway, getting back to the Coen brothers, like this is one of the films where you can see like they usually work with that usual crew of actors. Like obviously you got Frances McDormand, but one person behind the scenes that we forgot to talk about is their cinematographer Barry Sonnenfeld. So before they started working with Deakin, starting with Barton Fink, Sonnenfeld was their main cinematographer. And then in the 90s, Sonnenfeld moved on his own to become a director. He directed the Men in Black movies, Get Shorty, the Addams Family films. This is another example of like people that want to keep working with him, whether it's behind the scenes or in front of the camera.
Yeah, and another thing too is, you know, when you look at like the people that score their movies and they continue to come back, the set designers, the costume designers, I mean, people keep coming back. When you go through and look at not just the cast, but the crew, and of course they're obviously keeping their crew real small because, again, they're independent, so they don't have you don't have the same kind of set than when you're walking onto a Disney lot studio and looking at how many people are walking around and the billions upon billions of names that are in the credits for those movies.
Yeah.
I mean, sitting through the credits on a Coen Brothers movie is not a long thing.
Yeah. They even make up names like Roderick James for their editor.
Yes, that's so awesome. And the fact that these talents then go on to do other things. I mean, Roger Deakins, who is pretty much God in my world as far as cinematography is concerned, you know, he continues to come back and work on their projects, even though, you know, he goes and works with all these amazing other directors who have vastly, vastly different styles. You know, when you watch Blade Runner 2049, there's no Coen brothers there.
Yeah, that would be an interesting Blade Runner directed by the Coen brothers. That'd be interesting.
Oh, that would be epic. That would be epic. We need to get that happening right now because that would be amazing.
Oh, we know there that guy there is a replicant. We got to... Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. No, I think that would be totally awesome. But yeah, it's just like they nurture talent, they create talent. Even though Frances McDormand's in a lot of their movies, she's obviously gone on to have her own career outside of them.
Recently just won an Oscar.
Yeah, and that's funny too because last week when I asked my class, I'm like, hey, so what's your favorite Coen Brothers movie? This one woman, very proud, raised her hand. I said, yeah, and she said, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And I went, that is not a Coen Brothers movie.
Well, it's very Coen Brothers-ish, I would say.
It's like, that's Martin McDonagh, and he's great, and you should go and watch him Bruges, and yes, it's a wonderful movie, but it's not the Coen Brothers.
Yep.
But it's so interesting, too, that you can almost kind of see how somebody could mistake something like that.
Yeah.
Coen Brothers, because there is that dark humor, there is those kind of very intense situations going on in Three Billboards.
Yeah, definitely Coen Brothers-ish.
So yeah, so you can, you know, you can all, just like that, saying something is Coen Brothers-ish. There are obviously tons of movies and directors and actors that have been influenced by the style of these two guys, and that you can look at something and go, wow, that looks like the Coen Brothers.
Yeah.
So their innovations in the way that they approach, especially things like blocking, how far away you've got the camera from your subject, how you're filming shot reverse shot, all these things are starting to bleed into what we have as film grammar and are making a statement even beyond the Coen Brothers' own film.
And one thing, you know, we were talking off air. I know one of the problems I have with this movie, I know you have it too because you brought it up immediately, is you think that the characters in the movie make a lot of idiotic decisions. And I definitely agree. I remember especially watching this film again, because like almost like the main problem in the movie is people just aren't explicitly saying what, you know, what they did. It was the main thing is the couple, all the John Getz has to say is basically, I know you killed him and I buried the body. And he never says it once. And it causes all this sort of confusion. And then like, not only is he acting like an idiot, but like he doesn't act like an idiot just in that scene. It's the scene when he knows somebody's watching him. She turns on the light. He tells her, turn it off. She turns it on, turns it back on again. He's just standing all right out in the middle in plain view of everybody for a sitting duck. And what happens? He gets shot by the sniper. And I'm just like, you idiot. Yeah. You know somebody's watching you. Why are you basically presenting yourself to get shot?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the weirdness of this. And, I mean, obviously, when you watch a lot of Coen Brothers movies, you're going to run into people that are, instead of characters, caricatures. So you've got some kind of caricatures of types of people that will run around in these films. And not all of them are brain surgeons. You know,
nope.
Some of them are just kind of real everyday live people. And when you look at the setting, because, of course, I would love to do a direct compare and contrast to the opening sequence in this movie and the opening sequence in No Country.
Definitely.
Where you have these long shots establishing, you know, where the story is taking place, the voiceover that's going on, and explaining the people that live there and the kind of life that's existing there. But you get all these establishing shots. You see this dive bar that this guy owns, and, you know, how everybody's there just to, you know, get blasted, get wasted. It doesn't take, you know, too much math to do to be like, oh, so she got tired of the bar owner and, you know, started hanging out with the bartender, and that's your setup. That's it. Are these people making good decisions? No.
Mm-hmm.
Are they even nice people? Do we even like them? I would argue not really. I didn't really see anybody in this.
Not very likable.
No, I really hope that person makes it through. So there's really kind of no heroes in this film. So which to me makes it feel even more like a film noir, because the class I'm about to go into after our call is looking at how Coen Brothers like to play around with genre and sometimes subvert and sometimes align themselves to certain patterns. And a lot of film noirs that you're watching, even the protagonist is someone who you really couldn't care about. And I just thought, you know, that's kind of perfect, because these four people that keep banging into each other in this movie and doing all kinds of damage, none of them are really good.
No.
None of them seem to have any real good moral compass going on. They threaten each other. They harm each other. They kill each other. And it's just, it's ugly. It's seedy. It's the kind of thing where, you know, it's a bathroom stall that you don't want to enter. It's just something's wrong with it. And so you sit there for the hour and 38 minutes that the movie runs, and you have to sit there and deal with it. And it's just interesting, because they're not brain scientists. None of them are. And like I was saying to you, you know, when you get in these, you know, weird, wacky situations, or you're under that kind of duress, not everybody makes really good decisions. Not everyone says, you know, I mean, obviously, there's somebody across the street, and they're watching, and I know they're watching, so I'm going to go ahead and show my back to the window. You know, it's exactly what you were saying. It's just like, if they'd have put more math together in this, they could have come out better, but they don't. And that's kind of human nature, and that's sad, but it's true. It's very realistic in a sad way.
Going back to a little bit earlier, we were talking about like behind the scenes stuff. We talked a little about the score. I forgot. This score was composed by Carter Burwell, and Carter Burwell has worked with the Coen Brothers on pretty much every movie they've done. I think Big Lebowski and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? They had T-Bone Walker come in and do the soundtrack, and probably same thing Inside Llewyn Davis. But yeah, it's a good minimalist score, because it's pretty much just the piano, and it just kind of helps build those little tense scenes when like the private eye is sneaking through the house, and it's da 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 da. It's just this little piano, but it's a good minimalist score.
Yeah, I mean, there's the choices that they make music-wise, I think, are really interesting, because when you have something like A Raising Arizona, and you've got the banjo and whistling that goes along with that, and the yodeling and stuff, and it's just kind of an externalization of the situation that's in the movie, and how, you know, the music is just kind of as zany and wacky as what the heck is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the stuff that's in this movie is zany and wacky as well, but it's not getting the same kind of auditory palette that Raising Arizona does, even though it's coming from the same creators and the same musician. So that gives you a sense of the kind of range that's going on here, and how music is being incorporated into these movies. Because Situations Gone Wrong is kind of the Coen brothers' marching orders. And how you treat that with music is really going to have a huge influence over tone. So if your tone is something like, you know, the Raising Arizona, or, you know, there's not a lot of music in Barton Fink. It's very in the background, because the emphasis is on what's happening with the characters, what's happening with their facial expressions, and they have the capacity to turn that stuff down. But, you know, when you get into something that's a lot more louder and bombastic, like an Intolerable Cruelty, or like a Big Lebowski, you know, the music starts coming more to the forefront, and that's not to take away from what's happening with the characters. It's just another way to augment the situation.
Getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything else about the Coen brothers, or anything else that you want to bring up?
Funny, because I went back and I read Roger Ebert's two reviews of this movie, because one he did when the movie first came out in 1984, and the other was when he was doing his books of great 100 movies, and he did like 3 or 4 of those books. So he redid his review for the books, and he just talks about how it becomes a cliche that if you're trying to recommend a movie to someone and there's, you know, something gruesome in it, that you say, okay, this movie isn't for the squeamish. There is some really, really curdling areas of this film,
yeah,
where it's hard to watch. I mean, you're obviously watching a movie, you know it's fake, but oh my god.
He buries him alive.
Yes.
The knife in the hand.
Yes, the knife in the hand. Oh my gosh. And even all the way up to the end, the cool thing about this movie is just all the way up to the end, these characters still don't know what's going on, because she whispers, "See, I'm not afraid of you, Marty." And
he
the
just laughs.
Walsh character just starts laughing. He's just like, well, that makes two of us. I mean, because it's just like, she thought that was Marty.
Yeah.
It's just amazing that they kept that going all the way up to the last shot. And after that, you're in black. You fade to black, and it's the end, and the credits roll. Like, it's just so masterful. It's a really interesting film. I mean, I know a lot of people like Coen Brothers movies. They may not have seen this one. If you haven't seen this one, don't wait as long as I did to see it, because it's just really intricate. It's kind of like a little bit of a Rube Goldberg machine. Everything in it is going to fold in on everything else.
Yeah, and I think going back to what you talked about the violence, that one kind of brings back a bit to Sam Raimi. Because even going back to the Evil Dead movies, like, those movies have a lot of moments where they're extremely bloody, and a lot like that scene when she stabs the private eye's hand. There's a lot of bloody moments in that movies with somebody sawing off their arm or other things.
It's a story for you, all right?
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing the Coen brothers and their 1984 film Blood Simple. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com or the category Armchair Directors. Tune to Dragon Digital Radio to hear the show a week before it's on Podbean. Professor Dutter, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, give me a call whenever you want to cut off my head. I can always crawl around without it.